Hello out there. I hope everybody's sitting comfortably with their phones muted. Hello. Tonight, we are honored to host a VIP in the world of racing. Better still, a female VIP, recently inducted into the 2021 Motorsports Hall of Fame of America in the sports car category. Judy Stropas takes a rare break to join us tonight. Born in Lithuania, Judy landed in the U.S. in 1949 and tackled the English language as she attacked racetracks and sports cars all over New England. Soon she discovered she had a crazy talent for timing and scoring, garnering the attention and demand of teams and drivers in some of the highest levels of competition at the time. Her work with a stopwatch and a clipboard was uncannily accurate and indispensable. She traveled the country to races to perform this essential duty to offer to workshops to many whose teams needed the Stropas touch. Even after computers stole her job, her results were compared to the machine's numbers to test the effectiveness of the transponders. Doors opened to her everywhere she went. She had fresh ideas that would present the racing industry and all its figures and characters to the country through all forms of media. Auto racing became cool under Judy's PR spotlight, from sports cars to drag racing. Along the way, she made lifelong friends and earned the respect of CEOs of sponsor corporations, team owners, drivers, and sanctioning bodies. Along the way, she enjoyed messing around in cars on tracks. She makes competitiveness seem fun, but she's serious out there and has the wins to prove it. There is not one aspect of American racing, whether it's her time driving carts and sports cars or covering series from SCCA to the NHRA and NASCAR, that hasn't benefited from involvement with this enterprising lady. For 60 years, she has driven race cars and has literally written the book on timing and scoring while training many people that art in the days before transponders. She's run PR campaigns for teams, sanctioning bodies, sponsors, and her own personal brand, judged Concours all over the country, and has won some of the most prestigious awards, and is a fixture in a dozen or two notable racing organizations. She's truly racing's Renaissance woman. Welcome. We're so glad you're with us tonight, Judy, and welcome to everybody that's joined us. We're going to have a fine night. Thank you. Take it away. Hello? Judy? Judy, are you with us?
Hey, what's going on?
I don't know.
No!
Have we fallen into the twilight zone?
Judy's there.
Is anybody else there between you and I?
Janice in.
Okay. Something
we're
having.
Judy's there too. I'm not sure what she's doing there.
I hear you. I hear everybody. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, now I can.
Oh,
for a
okay.
while, I didn't. I was asking, I was expecting you to go on with, begin your talk, and didn't hear anything.
Well, I was expecting a question. So what would you like to know? You've pretty much covered my entire career in your introduction. So
That's just outlined. Where do you want to start? How did you get started?
Oh, my God. Back in the 60s, I had a boyfriend on Long Island when I lived in New York on Long Island, and he was the one interested in cars, and I was just 16, 17 years old. He taught me how to drive on his 120 Jaguar, and he had a 57 Chevy as well, and we joined the Queens Sports Car Club. That's a county on Long Island. Excuse me. And he raced the 120 Jaguar, and I'd go to all the races with him, and as I said, he taught me how to drive. And the women in the club were timing and scoring major racing events in Bridgehampton, Lime Rock, other, I can't even think of all the tracks that we had, Thompson. And so, and it was the New York Region SCCA. And so the USRRC would come to Bridgehampton, Can-Am later on. And so they taught me how to time, and I discovered that it was something that was quite easy for me, which surprised them. And I said, yeah, you know, this isn't that hard. So it didn't take long before teams were looking for that kind of service because there was no computers back then. This is BC, as Sylvia Wilkinson called it, before computers. And so I ended up, it's such a long story. I ended up also being the editor of the newspaper, their newsletter at the Queen Sports Car Club. So I would travel to the races to cover the members of the New York Region SCCA and the Queen Sports Car Club. I went to Marlboro, Maryland for the 5-hour Trans Am race, which had a under 2-liter race the day before, which I scored for a friend of mine. And I had crashed my Alfa Romeo by that time, and I had no car. And so my friends picked me up at on the bus station because I took a bus down there. And I happened to meet all the Ford people of the Mercury Cougar team on Saturday evening at a cocktail reception, and they mentioned that they needed timing and scoring because, you know, it wasn't considered at that time. So my friend Duke Manor, who was writing for Auto Week, said, well, Judy does that. And I said, oh, that's right, I do that. And they said, okay, we'll pay you $25. So I did the five-hour race. I scored the five-hour race the next day for the Cougar team, sitting on a toolbox with ramps over my head in case of rain. And I did the five-hour race. I got my $25, and I thought I was done, you know, and I went back up to New York with my friends who drove me back. And I had a call from Fran Hernandez from Ford and from Bud Moore, whose Cougar team it was, and they said, you have to come out to the West Coast for the other races, and that's how it all started. And the following year, their team was continuing with Ford Mustang. They were going to be running the Ford Mustang, and Ford at that point had their own scoring people. So I thought I was out of a job. But next thing I know, the Javelin team called me and said, you must work for us. I said, okay, I can do that. And in the middle of all that, Roger Penske walks up to me one day and says, just walks by and says, how come you're not working for me? And kept walking. And I ended up in 1967 working Trans Am for Javelin and Can-Am for Roger. And then the following year, I went full-time timing and scoring for Roger. So that's how I got that started. I have more, but ask me a question.
Somebody ask a question. How much racing were you doing on your own at that time?
Personally racing? I don't think I was racing yet. I started racing in the early 70s in vintage racing with an Oscar Maserati that was owned by Tony Koshland. He had two cars, and he raced one, and I raced one. And because I was a publicist and a PR person at that time, that was my own business, I was able to get a lot of media attention for our two-car team in vintage. And Jim Haynes, who ran Lime Rock at that time, credits us with starting the vintage racing craze back then in the early 70s. And the entire vintage racing just took off. And he gives us a lot of credit for that because we made it we had a lot of media.
I could imagine so. When you are racing in vintage now, what series are you racing?
Now? I'm not racing vintage now.
Oh, you're racing karts. Tell us about karts.
Well, I haven't even raced the go-karts in a while. I started to race go-karts at this charity event down in Jacksonville. It's a great racetrack, has a long straightaway, and the rest of it is a typical go-kart, but it has some sweeping turns, and it's really fun to race on. And it's a six-hour race, and I've done that for several years. I've set up my own team a couple of times. I've had Jack Baldwin driving, Buzz McCall driving, Brad McCall, Chip Robinson's son was doing a great job, Skyler, and Chip wasn't driving with us, but Skyler would drive with us, and we had such a good time, and we did so well. And then I would join Bill Warner's team, and there's four or five of us on a team for 6 hours, so we have 20 minutes on and off. And we ended up, the first year I was with Bill Warner's, we ended up fourth overall after 6 hours. And the only people in front of us were all the ringers that race go-karts all the time. So we did pretty well. I enjoy doing that, but it's conflicted with Long Beach Grand Prix, so the last couple of years, and I've had to go out to the Long Beach Grand Prix.
What are you going to do this year?
This year I'll be going to Amelia Island, Concours, in May, assuming that that will happen, where I'm a judge. And then right now it's only Concours. I have no racing schedule. I haven't had racing schedule since I technically retired from going to 40 races a year 10 years ago. So I'll be doing, I'll be covering different Concours, either doing PR and or judging. Actually, if I'm doing PR, I'm not judging. But the Hall of Fame dinner is in Pontiac, Michigan during the M1 Concours, which is the first time event. So it's early in the week in the end of September, and then I'll fly from there to Newport, Rhode Island, where I'm a judge at the Audrain. Newport, Rhode Island Concours, which will be the second year for them. And then a couple of weeks after that, I'll be in Chattanooga for the Motor Car Festival there, where I do the PR for them.
Okay. Trying to think. What's a great question? Somebody? Dave? I'd heard something about timing a 24-hour race. What's that like for the folks that have never done it?
Well, that's grueling. It's very difficult, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to plan for it. And clearly I was young at the time that I did most of the 24-hour races that I did. And you have to be prepared. You have to physically prepare yourself, mentally prepare yourself. And it's a lot of work, and it's not for the timid. And every year at 2:00 in the morning, I would look out and say, why in the world am I doing this? I'll never do this again. This is the craziest thing I've ever done. And of course I would do it again.
And nothing is more cold than sitting on the wall at Daytona when it's drizzling.
Well, luckily, I don't have to sit on the wall. I have a full timing stand and warm clothing and a cover for the papers if it rains. And we're pretty well equipped with the right equipment. And I don't, as you mentioned, clipboard. I've never used a clipboard in timing unless it was one car. But I have to set up a table and to be able to put my sheets down in order to time 20, 30, 40 cars.
I can't even imagine that. I can't even. I had a hard enough time doing one, and I was freezing my tail off.
Well, right. Well, it's a lot easier, believe it or not. Once you learn how to do it, it's a lot easier with one watch to time 10, 20 cars than it is to sit there timing one car with a clipboard with two watches on it. That's too hard, too complicated.
Well, I should have known that. I would have changed everything if I had known that. Knowing what clothes to bring would have helped, too.
Yeah, you have to be prepared.
Judy was being too modest, actually. You know, she taught everybody, all my people, how to time long-distance races. They wrote the book on it. And, of course, now computers replaced it all, so it's not as much fun, but you get up to go to the bathroom now.
Right, you didn't, for 24 hours, you couldn't go to the bathroom. You know, people say, well, how can you do that? Well, you have to do it. You have to be prepared, as I said, and make sure you don't drink water. I mean, I could never do it now, obviously. I'm too old, but when you're 20 years old, you can do all those things. And I knew, if I only knew then what I know now about preparing physically, it would have been a lot easier for me. But it wasn't that difficult. It just was long. And years later, when I would cover the 24-hour races as a PR person, I would say, oh, my God, this is like forever. And then I think about the times that I would be sitting up there on the timing stand for the entire time, writing numbers constantly, never stopping. It's unbelievable to me that I did that. I can't even believe I did that.
It's amazing. How long did it take you to write your book?
Oh, about 10 years. Because it was not something I sat down. Once I sat down to write it, it took me like a few days. But getting myself to sit down and start writing it was time consuming. I didn't have the time. I have my other businesses and the other things I was doing. That writing a book was not high priority for me. But that book was from 1974, I think it was published. And I mean, the basics are the same. And I'm surprised. I mean, they printed very few. They printed only about 300, so they're out there floating around, and people are selling them used ones at high prices. There was one on auction, and two of my friends were trying to outbid each other for the book, and one of them got it, obviously.
For those that don't know, the book is called The Stropus Guide to Auto Race Timing and Scoring.
And
so if you happen to walk up on one in an antique store, then get it, you know.
It's a title that Carl Ludvigsen, for whom I was working as his assistant back in the late 60s, early 70s, and he's an author. And so I provided a title for one of his books, and in turn I said, well, then you have to provide the title for my book. So that was his title. He came up with that.
Well, he did very well. It says it all. Anybody?
Yeah, so listen, Judy, tell us about your showroom stock racing career.
Well, it was, what happened was I was racing the Oscars and vintage racing. And somewhere at Lime Rock at a dinner during a professional race, people from Dunlop. And it was a media dinner, and people from Dunlop were there, and Bill Broderick, if people know Bill Broderick, he's called Hat Man in NASCAR, was at one time, and he was the Union 76 representative, and he was there. So it was a table full of different sponsors, different people, and it very much like my timing career started. They're talking, and Bill Broderick says, you know, to the Dunlop guy, you need to sponsor Judy. You know, she will do a great job for you as a driver, and you can use her for marketing and PR. And I said, yeah, I can do that, you know. So the Dunlop people said, you know what, that's not a bad idea. Why don't you give us a proposal? So I knew how to do those things. That was my business. So I wrote up a proposal, sent it to them, and they accepted it. And now, I did not have an SCCA license yet. I was racing vintage. So I quickly got an SCCA license, and I called upon all my friends to provide everything I needed. So Al Holbert provided me the Scirocco Volkswagen Scirocco to use. I joke about this because I think Skip Barber loaned me the Nomex underwear. Bob Sharp loaned me something else. My Ferrari dealer friend gave me a trailer to get the Scirocco up to wherever I had to go to SCCA racing school. I borrowed everything. I had my own helmet and my own driver's suit because I was racing vintage. So I had to borrow everything. So I went through the SCCA driving school, got my license, and started racing showroom stock in the Scirocco originally. And Al Hobart used to fly in on his plane to different racetracks and help me get oriented to the car and to racing professionally somewhat, because I ran club racing for a while. I get lost in the sequence of when I did certain things, but I know I think it was, I don't know which car I rolled into a ball at the end of the straightaway and at Bridgehampton, but I ended up in trees where nobody's ever been, and that was my learning front wheel drive. So once I learned front wheel drive, I did fine. I really don't remember where. I never owned a race car in my life, and I'm not entirely sure where all these race cars came from, but Dunlop clearly had something to do with it. So the problem with the Volkswagen was, and that advertisement you've seen with Dunlop where I'm featured with a Volkswagen, and I'm the Chevrolet representative at that time, the PR representative, and I never realized that ad would be so prominent, car forward. And so Chevy people said, you know, that's kind of, you know, you're representing Chevrolet and this is a Volkswagen. I said, okay. So then I decided, we decided, Bill Mitchell was preparing my car, and we decided we should get a Chevrolet. So we got a Chevy Monza, and it got to be known as the Killer Bee because we did really well with that. Went to the runoffs in 1979. Started up front. I can't remember where, top five, but I spun early, but I ended up making my way back, and I actually beat the defending national champion in that class, which was Showroom Stock A. And then I started to I can't remember. Oh, Dunlop. I think Dunlop had gone away after 4 years. We did enough. They were happy with everything that happened. Then I went to Volkswagen Cup Racing, and I paid for that. No sponsor. I just said, you know what? I like the idea of not having to be the PR person, the owner, the team owner, the manager, the driver. And I just rented the rides in Volkswagen Cup. And that was the best time I think I ever had racing cars. They were the best people. Tim Elliott owned the car. He was awesome. My darling team owner, I called him. And we raced Peter Schwarzott, Alistair Ogue, the Hackers. I even raced Hackers' cars a couple of times, maybe first. I can't remember. Again, I can't remember the sequence of events. But I had the best time in Volkswagen Cup, absolutely the best time. And
that sounds like too much fun. Well, what did you enjoy most, the PR or the driving?
I enjoy all of it.
Yeah, I could tell that you did.
I enjoy the PR.
Okay, PR is a broad subject. What exactly did you do?
I still do.
Well,
that's hard to explain.
I know.
I'm a publicist, so I represented Chevrolet. I represented Chevrolet originally on the product side in New York City, and then they were not openly racing, although they were involved. But once they got involved openly in racing, I was the first publicist that they retained for racing PR. So I started with SCCA and Trans Am, and then went to IMSA in the prototype GTP, and then I even did NASCAR one or two years for Chevrolet, and NHRA for Chevrolet. So I, the first team I worked with was Don Perdone's team, and I show up, and they, you know, they have no clue of my history in sports car racing, and so he just thinks I'm some sort of Chevrolet executive, and he says, "Come, stand here." And this was in Phoenix, and Larry Dixon was about to do his burnout in the top fuel dragster. And he says, "Here, put your fingers in your ears." And the rumbling and the tires swelling up and the noise and the dust and the smell and everything. And he thought he was really getting, you know, really giving me a show. And, of course, he was. And it just put a smile on my face. But it was the last time I stood on the line. I spent the rest of my time with NHRA in the press room and in the teams. I didn't need to be standing out there on the starting line.
The fumes are enough to drive you out of there.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And that's what I tried to avoid most of the time. But I had a great time with NHRA, first with Chevrolet, and then when they ran the Pro Stock trucks. And then Chevrolet went away eventually during that during the issues in the 70s. And then so Don Schumacher called me and said, "You should work for me." So I worked for Don Schumacher Racing on the PR side, obviously, for 8 years. And then 10 years ago, I retired from going to 40 races a year. And that was from NHRA, and I've been retired technically, but I'm semi-retired, I guess, because I still do a lot of PR work with the Concours and representing authors and publishers. So, but I don't have to go to 40 races a year, and that's good.
Yeah, you've probably traveled more than anybody.
Pretty much.
Yeah, I would imagine so.
There were years when I would be public relating, driving, timing, sometimes the same weekend. So I would go from one to the other or to the other or to the other. Not usually timing and driving at the same time, but sometimes if a lesser race is held the day before, or I'd race that race, and then I'd get on the timing stand. But that was rare. That was, like, too much. And then I had assistants. I had people working for me on the PR side. And then Chevrolet finally said, "Well, why don't you, maybe you should think about just not timing any longer and working more for us than having assistants." And I said, "You know what, it's about time." I thought it would be the right time. And it was before the computers came in, but it was just before the computers came in that I retired from timing and spent more time with Chevrolet and other clients that I had PR-wise.
Who did you like to work for the most?
Say that again.
Who did you like to work for the most? What was your favorite client?
Oh, they're all great. I have every client I had was the best. That's
a very diplomatic way to answer that question.
I enjoyed working for all of them, and there was great respect. I mean, I was with Chevrolet for like 40 years. I was with BMW for 10 years at the same time as Chevrolet. And I had many other clients that were long-term clients. And so that was very, very rewarding, a lot of hard work, but a lot of great respect from the people I worked with, and it was very enjoyable.
Obviously, the fact that you were a female was never a deterrent for getting what you needed, getting up to, you know.
I always like to say I didn't know I was a woman. I just did what I did. The only time I realized that I was different was when I started to race cars. And obviously I was going through the SCCA schools and then running regionals or whatever. And, you know, it took me a little bit to go fast. And the guys were getting pissed off. Or am I allowed to say that?
Yes.
And so they really annoyed me. And I said, well, you know, I just sped up the process of learning and got to be really good and blew their doors off, and I was happy about that. So that's the only time. And then I gained their respect. Not everyone's respect, but most of the people's respect. That's why in the Volkswagen Cup, we had such a good time. I was usually the only girl. There was another woman who raced in Volkswagen Cup every once in a while. In fact, we had a good race in Memphis. She and I drafted together and passed all the guys and finished up front somewhere. But we had that was so much fun because we just latched on.
Oh, did you see it?
Pardon?
That's fabulous. That's fabulous. Okay, what are you going to throw out here now?
Well, actually, Judy, while you're talking about cars, all these exotic cars like Monzas, how about a mention of that AMC Pacer that you drove one time? Not many people even know what a Pacer is anymore.
I know. My car friends were always joking about the Pacer because the Concorde, what was the name of it? It was online. It was on Facebook. It was a Concorde of model cars, and I won the chairman's award with the Pacer model that an old boyfriend had made. I had a boyfriend back in the 70s, 80s, who made models of the cars I was racing. And so I have the Monza, I have the Volkswagen, and I have the Pacer. So I submitted the Pacer to the to this Concours and online on Facebook, and Andy Reid gave me the chairman's award for the car. And it's, so I raced that in the Kelly American Challenge. And we were doing so well that the owner, the gentleman who owned it, said, oh, we're going to put a V8 in it. So I said, okay. And as soon as I drove out and rode Atlanta, a couple of laps, and I came in and I said, I think the axle is broken. I think that was too much power. And he said, no, you're just not doing it right. So he got in the car. I don't know how he was able to get in the car, but maybe we were co-drivers or something. And he got in the car and came back, and he says, yep, the axle is broken. So... But it was, it was great. I mean, it's great to relive those days now and to see the pictures of that car and then the model car that is getting so much attention.
I'm trying to envision it. I've never seen it, but that would have been a hoot.
Yeah, there's pictures around. You probably find it online.
I'm sure I could. Thanks for letting me know. I'll go looking for it. So where do you keep all these models and trophies and stuff?
In the family room, I have all these shelves, and I collect model cars of the teams I've worked with as well. So I have a lot of those. They're not displayed as nicely as they should be, but I've got all the different trophies and awards and my office in. I have my office in the house also, and that's pretty good size, and many of the plaques and awards are hanging on the wall there. And some, actually there are some, a couple of my awards are up here. I have the Bob Aiken Award up here, and then I was given last year, the year before, God, it's like 2020 has disappeared. We keep saying last year, but we mean 2019. And so the Turtle Invitational Award is up here in a bookcase up in the main level of the house.
The Turtle
otherwise,
Award.
Otherwise, there are no, in the main part of the house, there are no car posters or framed car things. But in the guest wing, I have a lot of posters and a lot of pictures and a lot of signed memorabilia in the guest wing.
How fun. That's great. Anybody out there?
And how about that Lancia Appia? Do you still have that?
The what?
The Lancia.
Lancia Appia.
Oh, yeah, the Lancia Ardea. Yep, it's out in the garage. I am waiting for the mud to dry up, so I'll take it for a drive and warm it up and keep it going. Lancia Ardea, 1952 Lancia Ardea. We ran the 2013 California Millet with it. I bought it from Donald Osborne in 2013, and when Donald Osborne was living in Connecticut, the car was here, but I bought it when it was in California. So I bought it from Donald in Palm Springs. And then I realized that it was eligible for the California Millet. So my friend Chuck Schoendorf, who's a Lancia guy here and a Cunningham guy here in Connecticut, I said, Chuck, you want it? Should we do it? Let's drive it as long as the car is out in California before it comes home. And so we did, and it's only a 28.8 horsepower V4, and I had my friend Jerry Woods, who prepares Porsche racing cars in California. I had him set the car up, prepare it for, 1,000 miles to run in San Francisco. So he's down in, can't remember the town, but it's near San Jose. So the car went there. Jerry went down to Palm Springs, picked up the car, and took it up to that town near San Jose and set the car up for the Millet. And then we flew out and we drove the car up to San Francisco, up the steep hills, only 28 horsepower. And it's no synchro in the first gear. You have to be standing still to get in first gear. But Chuck had a lot of experience with these cars, so he did a great job on driving up the steep hills. And we finished. This was the only time in the California Millet that there were two Lancia Ardeas. Martin Swig, who organized the event, had purchased an Ardea in Italy and had it shipped over for the Millet in 2013. He unfortunately passed away before the Millet, and so his sons drove the other Ardea, but they didn't have time to really prepare it for 1,000 miles. So they quit driving. They had some minor, they weren't major issues, but they decided to stop running, and we continued on, so we finished 1,000 miles. There were cars, there were Ferraris, there were Ferraris, Alfa Romeos on flatbeds being towed to a repair shop while our little 28 horsepower kept going. Car kept going, but it we had issues. It wasn't perfect, but we kept going. I thank the people from Chubb, who were the support team for all the cars running on the Millet, and they were there in case you broke down or you needed gas. And so they got to know us quite well because we were breaking down minor issues. So they asked me, the Greenwich Concours was happening after that, Greenwich, Connecticut, right after that. So when they said, can you bring the Ardea we'll put it on display in our tent in Greenwich. So I made sure that we had the car shipped back in time for the Greenwich Concours, and it sat there in their tent with the description of having run the 1,000 miles in 2013. They made a beautiful sign telling the whole story. Unfortunately, I can't fit it in the car. It won't fit in the car. So I have it in down in the family room, but I can't take it with me when I bring the car anywhere because it won't fit. Have to cut it in two pieces and slice it
down. Oh, no, just let somebody photograph it and shoot it down and then reproduce it.
Well, yeah, but it's a big car, big poster board sign.
It can be done.
I know, but I haven't done it.
We want you to have your sign.
That's okay. They can make another sign. What else?
Yeah, now we got the big elephant in the room here. How about the Motorsports Hall of Fame?
Yay. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Well, I'll be inducted in as I said, in September, the end of September, up in Pontiac, Michigan, they'll have the two dinners. They'll be inducting the 2020 class as well on the Monday, and the 2021 class will be on Wednesday, the last week of September. I'll give you the exact dates. I have my calendar here. September 27th will be the 2020 class induction, and then the 29th will be the 2021 induction. And on the 28th, I guess they'll actually do some other supportive events for both of the classes. And then that weekend is the M1 Concours. That's brand new, first year, and I'll be flying out because I'm a judge at the Newport, Rhode Island Concours, and I'll be interviewing Lynn St. James there as well. But Lynn is being honored at Amelia Island also, and I wrote the story for the program on her, so I'm well-versed on Lynn, and she's a good friend.
I'm sure she is. Yeah, I saw her at TV.
Hey, Jay, it's Janet.
That's coming from Jay.
Hello?
You want to open this up to some questions?
Yeah, there you go.
How about Rick Newp? Are you there, Rick?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you guys hear me?
Dave, you got a lot of static.
I do?
No, it comes from Dave.
Oh.
I can hear you, Rick.
Oh,
go ahead,
hey, Jim. You know what? I was just going to bring up a couple of things. Number one, the Hall of Fame, great job. I don't think any of us are surprised. And what a beautiful way to be presented with the Woodward in the M1 facility, and you know, our mutual friend Tim McGrane,
yes,
is now sort of pushing the pedals over there, and there's been some lovely stuff about it. But I was going to say that to me, Judy, my first year of professional racing was 1978, and then I was 24 years old, and the thing that was interesting was I was watching an awful lot of this because I started kind of like on the West Coast, what Judy was doing with Oscars, and Joel Finn was a mutual friend of my dad's, Fred, and we were doing our footprint out here with Steve Earle and Bob Aiken. Then all of a sudden we're all sort of kind of cross-pollinating, if you will. And I also drove a Pacer, Judy. With Amos Johnson in the Champion Spark Plug Classic,
right.
Do you remember they put Dennis Shaw and I together, and Peter Gregg was with Nick Craw, and we were getting the same points in the Champion Spark Plug series as we would get at Le Mans, Monza, and all of a sudden I was in the points race, and gosh darn it, there's a guy named, it was George Dyer's car that Busby had prepared, and I was co-driving with Steve Earle and Bob Aiken. So I had a little bit of your East Coast friend Bob and Ellen Aiken with me, and then I've got Steve Earle, and we're driving George Dyer's car that Busby's doing. And then I am walking around you guys, and I see this woman, and it's Judy. And I said, good Lord, what is going on there? This is my first 24-hour race, first time in IMSA, in the RSR that Buzz had prepared. So Judy is timing, and it looked like about the size of a ping pong table on its side. And I was going, holy crap. So one of my driving stints at that witching hour that Judy was talking about, 2 in the morning, holy crap, it's about 32 degrees. So I'm watching this in just amazement, and we're, you know, we're running and kind of doing our stuff. Well, right alongside of me was Hal Shaw in the rumor, and Busby were teamed up in the Ore House, which was a 934/935. So Busby's going over and looking at Judy Stropas's timesheet to see what this kid Noop was doing in terms of consistency. So now I'm thinking, well, my God, that's Judy Stropas. I read The Unfair Advantage. My dad's a vintage car racer. Steve Griswold and Bob Aiken and Ellen and Joel Finn. So I didn't realize this until tonight. Okay, Oscars, I grew up with those in Berkeley with the Dan Marvins, and I've never driven one. But there's Steve Griswold, there's Judy Stropas, and the whole thing was meant to happen. And it's just, I have to say, some of the highlights was number one, being accepted into one of the premier road racing series. John and Peggy Bishop, I think when it's all said and done, had a pretty good deal. And then all of a sudden, we do more races. And I think the one thing I would love to share is if Judy was timing for the particular team that I was lucky enough to be around, and a lot of thanks I'll always have for another great friend of mine, Jim Busby. But then you knew you were basically on the right heading, if you will, because, you know, from the Bud Moores to the Penske's, and you don't really name drop, but what you're doing is there's a bedrock there. And I used to just come back to the hotel room after the end of the race and go, good Lord, thank God this car finished. And because, you know, in racing, if you put it through the fence at one track, you kind of wear that for a while. And to have Judy timing, and it was, and then the friendship, and, you know, my goodness, I kind of hate to throw it out there, but what the hell, we've been sort of best buds for about four decades. So the time goes, and I have a picture, Judy, that I cherish, and I think I sent it to you last week. It's you and I at Dan Gurney's, I think it was his 80th birthday party.
It was, with Bruce Meyer, yeah.
Bruce Meyer, and then also, and I'm not name dropping, but I've just got to say this on this wonderful moment celebrating Judy and stuff, is when we were on top of Switzerland and a little bit of this place called Italy on the way to Lake Como. Now, it sounds like I'm full of it, kind of crossing boxes with you all. But we're standing up there, Busby, Judy, myself, and we're kind of looking around and said, what, are we hungry? Go, hell yeah, we are. So we all tootle in our little rented cars, and we went to the Villa d'Este, and I thought, holy crap, if I drop dead now, I'm just going to call it. It was a short season for me, but here I am at Lake Como having hors d'oeuvres or whatever with you guys. And little did I know after that it would be 30 years of more activity. So awfully proud to know you. And I got to say one thing in closing. I hope we all got a hell of a lot more years of doing this, because it gets our damn minds off this big cloud and viruses, whatever in the hell else is going out there. We're having fun tonight.
Yes, and let's tell the story of at Le Mans with the Mazda C2 class. Busby, you were driving. I put all the wives to work timing. Susan was timing. Your wife was timing. And 24 hours later, and you know, it was the Mazda, and had a Japanese driver, and the Mazda officials and executives were all there. And at the end of the race, and the team won the C2 class at the Le Mans, 24 hours of Le Mans, I don't know what year, 80-something. And at the end of it, I go to the hospitality area, and I sort of lay down, get a beer, and just laying there, and I see this wall of people coming at me, and I go, uh-oh. And they're all the Japanese, the executives of Mazda, their wives, the driver, who I don't remember his name, Rick, you might remember. And I get up, and I stand there, and they all walk up to me. They bow in unison to me and say, thank you for a perfect job. And to this day, that still gives me chills.
Oh, still, my goodness.
and I told Buzz, I told Noop that story last time that we talked, because he didn't remember that. Well, you wouldn't have remembered it because it was my story. You know, you weren't there at that moment.
Oh my goodness!
Great.
Actually,
story.
I feel like
I've unmuted all you other guys. Anybody have anything to say? Go ahead. Now.
Hi, it's Janet. I just wanted to say, hey, Judy, and congratulations. It's more than well-deserved. And I hope to see you in Amelia. And I've got one quick question.
Okay. Who is this? I'm sorry. Who are you?
It's Janet, Upchurch.
Oh, hi, Janet. How are you?
Good. Are you doing okay?
Yeah.
Well, congratulations. But
thank you.
I want to know one thing. Is there anything that you have not done that you wanted to do?
Anything? Like anything?
Anything.
I mean, I'm joking when I say I would have liked to have married a billionaire, but that didn't happen. So.
Me too.
You know, I don't. I wish I could ski better than I ski, but I don't have enough. I don't like skiing in the east, so I go to Vail. I used to go to Vail, Colorado, every December. And I would like to have been able to ski more to improve, but skiing for 1 week every year is not enough. I mean, I did want to, as a kid, I did want to go out, to go into space. I did want to do that, and I still want to do that. Maybe I'll go when they, on Tesla's cruise ship up there.
There you go. Okay. Good night.
Anybody else out there? Questions for Judy?
I have one. Okay.
Nope.
My name is Helen. Hi, Judy.
Hi.
Walk me or walk us through a timing and scoring lap. What you actually do, what actually happens when you were doing it manually.
Okay, so timing is during practice and qualifying.
Right.
So I have my timing stand on, I'm up high, I'm looking out. I have my sheets, six columns per sheet, so I put out four or five sheets, so each column is a car, and sometimes I double up. I know the cars that may not run many laps, so I can double up. So that's... five sheets is 30 cars or so. And I have my stopwatch that has, originally it was a Heuer watch with a sweeping hand, and you stop the hand and you read the time, you write it down at the bottom of the column of the car that came by you, and you stop the watch at a line that's directly in front of you, and don't use a jacket on a fence or a person because they move. So you have to have a permanent stationary line in front of you that you use. Could be a tree, whatever it is. Could be the bar and the guardrail. and you use that line. And you have to know the cars. You have to know the cars. The numbers were much bigger back then because they didn't have computerized timing. Now the numbers are very small. But back then they were bigger for the officials to read. They didn't do it for me, but they did it so the officials could read them properly. And so you write down each time that car comes by into that car's column, and then the next time it comes by, you do the same thing, and then you subtract those two times, and you come up with a lap time. And that's how you can do 20, 30 cars. You just every time, and you learn how to estimate by the speed of that they go by on that particular track. There are different tricks that you can use and be accurate, but that's how you do it.
Yeah, it's looking up and down, looking up and down.
Constantly, yep. And then and giving the information to your team as it's happening as well. Then you have to hand the sheet. I used to have a magnetic board up front, and I'd have people help me put the numbers up on the board so the team could read it. And then later on, I decided to, when I, so many teams wanted my services that I was working for 12, 15 teams at a 24-hour race or even shorter races. I set up a system with monitors. So this gentleman out in California called and says, I can help you. And I said, okay, here's what I want to do. It's not computerized timing. It's still manual, but my assistant next to me will read over my shoulder and punch the numbers in, and they'll show up on the screens. So I spent so much time with coaxial cables going down the pits with a screen for every team that was paying me, not the other teams, and that took so much time and so much work. They thought they were getting computerized timing, but I called it placebo timing. What they were getting was the computer. The only thing it did was put in order the lap times, so you could read lap times during the race. We had for the scoring part of it, we had a system where my assistant would punch in the numbers and of the positions, and then separating how many laps behind. So she did most of that work, but that was so time-consuming to put up these monitors and then take them down after you've been up for 24 hours. And now I have a box. There's a box somewhere missing. I had it stored at Lime Rock. Someone had offered to store this box with all my stopwatches and all these other items and coaxial cables, whatever, at a shed at Lime Rock at the end of the straightaway. I went, and that was years ago. I mean, that's what, 80, 90. And so I went looking, about 3 years ago, I went looking for that shed and it wasn't there anymore. So I don't know where this box of stuff is anymore. But that was the beginning of the end of my timing and scoring, because that was so much work. And there were times when the smartest engineers, mechanics would come running up in the beginning of a race and say, it's not working. I send somebody down and they just didn't turn it on. You know, little things like that's got to be a little. So it was a lot of work, and so that helped me decide that it was time to quit.
Yeah, hey Judy, one last timing mention here: the 1985 Playboy race at Riverside, where you saved everybody's bacon by sitting down.
I did not. I was racing in that race.
I know.
Sylvia Wilkinson is the one who saved the day. I had nothing to do with the timing and scoring.
I thought Sylvia used your notes to sort out the actual results.
I didn't do any notes. I had my doubts about whether the timing and scoring would be accurate in this race. All I did was have my team make sure that they counted every single lap of the car I was racing. And that is the sheet she used just for our car. So she knew where we, at least how many laps, that ours was accurate, and she knew how many laps that we had run. That was it. I didn't have anything to do with that. That was all Sylvia. She saved the world in the day that day.
Yeah, she took all that info and saved the day, that's for sure.
Yeah, I could only give her the information on my one car. So.
Okay, any other questions here? Otherwise, we've used up about an hour. And, Trish, you got a couple announcements to make?
Next, 2 weeks from tonight, we will have Doc Bundy with us. And he's quite a talker, and he's going to have a lot to say. He's got a lot to talk about, and I know everybody will want to check in and see how he's doing and learn about his career. What else?
That's it. The recording of this will be on the Racing History Project website tomorrow, so if you missed it, anybody listening in, tell your friends, racinghistoryproject.com. And back to Trish. And Judy, by the way, thanks. It was a great interview. Enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you.
Judy, I've enjoyed it immensely. Our talk the other night was a lot of fun. I learned a lot. And having you here tonight was very, very special for me. And
thank you very much.
I hope you'll check back with us periodically and listen to our future talks. And
I'll try to do that. Thank you very much for everybody.